Advisement. Our next case this morning is Resnick against the United States. All right, and I see both counsel. Can you both hear me?
I apologize, judges. I was unable to hear you. Were you speaking with me?
I was. Can you hear me now?
I can. Thank you, Judge.
Okay. Very well. You may proceed.
Okay, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Edelstein. I represent the appellant, David Resnick. On February 22nd, 2013, 9 days after an interrupted plea colloquy, the government stood before the district judge and moved to withdraw from its plea agreement, saying that the defendant had failed to accept responsibility because on the ground of falsely denying or frivolously contesting relevant conduct. However, the government did acknowledge in the same colloquy, in the same motion, that a defendant is not required to volunteer or affirmatively admit relevant conduct before the beyond the offense of conviction and was entitled to stand mute. That was the perfect opening, or would have been the perfect opening, for Mr. Resnick's counsel. He should have said at that point to the district judge that Mr. Resnick was not given the chance to stand mute. That the reason why he denied what the government contended was relevant conduct was that the government recited that conduct, and then the magistrate judge asked him whether or not he agreed with it. The magistrate judge put him in a position where he couldn't stand mute, where he either had to agree with or deny this conduct. So when this got to the district judge 9 days later, counsel should have made a motion for specific performance on the ground that Mr. Resnick was deprived of his right and his ability to stand mute.
Mr. Edelstein, could I ask
yes.
you? When was the defendant bound by this plea agreement?
When was the defendant bound by it?
Yes.
Excuse me a second. Let me just find the date of the plea agreement.
Well, the date it was signed certainly didn't make it binding, did it? He would have been free to change his mind at any point during any of the colloquies with the court, correct? Before the court accepted it.
Yes, he would have been free at the time of the colloquy.
So he was not bound. When was the government bound?
I think the government was bound when the plea agreement was executed.
It be that one party is bound and the other is not?
Well, because the defendant and the government are not in the same position with respect to plea agreements. The defendant has certain constitutional rights, including the right to withdraw his plea. The government was bound by the plea subject to the defendant's exercise or non-exercise of those rights.
What's the authority for that? What's your authority for that approach? That the government is bound by the written terms before the defendant has made his plea before the court and the court has accepted it?
Your Honor, given that that issue was not briefed by the parties, I don't have authority right at hand. However, if this court would like me to brief that issue, I certainly can. The government has never contended, either in the district court or before this court, that it was not bound. And I think that if there had been a situation where Mr. Resnick had violated the plea agreement by withdrawing it, by saying, no, Judge, I don't want to plead guilty, then, you know, the government would have been released. It wouldn't have been bound. However, he didn't do anything to violate the plea agreement. And and our position is that the government was bound, that it had entered into a contract. There certainly wasn't anything in the contract that said that the government would not be bound until such and such a future date. And this court, like other circuit courts, has held that plea agreements must be strictly construed in the defendant's favor and against the government. So if the government didn't reserve the right in the plea agreement to not be bound until a future date, then it was bound. And if Mr. Weigel, the defendant's counsel, had made a motion for specific performance, this motion would have had merit. It would have had to be granted. The district court, in fact, when the district court determined the 2255 motion, it didn't even dispute that. What the district court said instead was that there was no prejudice because of an intervening plea offer later on that was rejected. And our position is that was a red herring for a couple of reasons. First of all, that this was not the same offer. The original offer was a 20-year cap. The second offer was a 20-year C plea. So Mr. Resnick was prejudiced by the loss of the possibility of a sentence of less than 20 years. And I'll remind the court that under the precedent of the Seventh Circuit, the standard for prejudice in ineffective assistance cases is better than negligible. So really, all he would have to show is that there's a better than negligible chance that he would have received the more favorable outcome had this plea gone through. But more to the point,
you haven't made any argument to that effect with respect to the first plea agreement. The agreement was for sentencing enhancements that yielded a guidelines range of life. And you haven't made any plausible argument that the judge would have come in under the statutory maximum of 20 years based on those enhancements.
Well,
not even a better than negligible chance that this sentence would have come in under 20 years. Or at least you haven't made any argument to that effect. So the second plea agreement was the same sentence without having to admit the relevant or admit the conduct underlying the enhancements because it was a lock-in plea agreement.
Well, I would submit, Judge, that we have made that argument and we've made the argument that the guidelines were advisory and that it always would have been open to the judge to sentence him to less than 20 years. And
was,
that
was
given
there
that
any
he was
reasonable
doing a
possibility of that? You
well,
have to
given
demonstrate
that
a reasonable
court,
possibility that the result would have been different.
Well, given that Mr. Resnick was already doing a 10-year sentence in the Florida case, the judge might have decided that less than 20 additional years was enough.
That's an Maybe, assertion. That's not an argument.
Well, with any prejudice argument.
On these facts, Mr. Edelstein, realistically, is there any chance that this would have been anything other than a maximum sentence with these guidelines enhancements admitted?
No. Sexual, Your Honor, I think that
a pattern
with any
of sexual abuse, a pattern of interstate transit with child pornography, enhancements that created a guideline sentence of life.
Well, it was reserved in the plea agreement.
Understood,
as to
but
whether,
was there any realistic possibility? What would the argument have been?
Well, what I was saying, Judge, was that it was reserved in the plea agreement whether any sentence would be concurrent or consecutive. It is possible that the judge might have decided to impose a consecutive sentence to make clear that this was for different conduct than the Florida case. However, it might have decided that 20 years on top of the 10 was too much, and maybe another 15 would have been enough.
Based on what arguments in mitigation of his conduct in this case, your client's conduct in this case? You have to have a mitigation argument, and you haven't advanced one. You're just asserting that it was possible. That's not an argument.
But moving beyond that, Judge, the fact of the matter is that if this plea, if specific performance had been granted, this plea would have gone through. He would have gotten a sentence of 20 years or possibly less, maybe not less, but a subsequent offer never would have come into play. That this offer is neither here nor there. I mean, this is not a situation where a defendant rejected a plea of his own volition and then was subsequently given a better offer. This is a situation where the defendant was in the middle of allocuting. He would have accepted this plea. It would have gone through. He would have been 100% bound by it. So there never would have been a subsequent offer. There never would have been a trial.
Was the court bound to accept it?
The court could, I mean, the court always has the authority to reject the plea agreement. However,
including
the court
did
not.
Including on the grounds that the parties didn't actually agree, given the confusion here about what was expected to be admitted, and the magistrate judge gave you all time to consult and see if you could reach a specific agreement on those points, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that there was no genuine confusion, that the plea agreement, to the extent that there was any ambiguity in it, which we would submit there was not, there are rules of construction that ambiguity has to be constructed.
Well, Judge Radovich was obviously very uncomfortable accepting an agreement to sentencing enhancements that kicked the guideline range up to life and certainly well over the statutory maximum of 20 years without knowing there was a factual basis for it. Now, he could have accepted it without the defendant's admission, but was it improper for Magistrate Judge Radovich to have asked the questions that he did?
Yes, Your Honor, I would submit that it was, because
the judge
Mr.
is not
Resnick,
entitled, is not permitted to ask the defendant. I did that all the time. In every case, I would ask the defendant to at least say whether he disagreed with the government's proffer of the facts.
Well, in a case such as this, where the defendant has explicitly stated on the record that he agrees to the enhancements, that he agrees to them being imposed, and where the plea has been limited so that he is pleading guilty only to a certain offense, not to the relevant conduct, he has a right under the precedence of this court and of other circuits to stand mute. In fact, even the government acknowledged that when they moved to withdraw the plea. So I would submit that, yes, it was improper to put him in a position where he was not able to stand mute. The court could have, in order to relieve its any concerns it may have had about a factual basis, the court could have asked the government, what evidence do you have to support that there's a factual basis for these enhancements? And the government could have said, well, there was an interview with the police, which we would present to the court at the time of sentencing, and could have shown that to Magistrate Judge Radovich. And therefore, there was a way for the magistrate judge to alleviate any concerns he may have had without putting Mr. Resnick in an impossible position. I notice I've gone, I've exceeded my time, other than what I've reserved for rebuttal. I have reserved 5 minutes. So if the court has no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve.
That's fine. Mr. Whalen.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Nathaniel Whalen here on behalf of the United States of America. Your Honors, I'd like to kind of pick up where you left off, which is, if the argument is the magistrate Judge Radovich committed some error, that's something that could have been raised on direct appeal. That's long procedurally defaulted. It's long waived. The question is whether defense counsel is constitutionally ineffective as it relates to this plea agreement. And I think, Judge Sykes, you've hit the prejudice point on the nail on the head. It's not only that there's no reasonable probability there's going to be less than a 20-year sentence. In this plea agreement, the defendant himself agreed that there was no reason for a below-guideline sentence. He was going to recommend 20 years because the guidelines are going to be at life, and then that's going to come down to 20 years as a result of the statutory maximum. So he bound himself to say to the district court, a 20-year sentence is appropriate in this case. And where the second plea really comes into play, the one that he rejects, is the question of causation, whether defense counsel's performance is what caused the defendant prejudice. The second plea shows that it wasn't defense counsel's performance. It was actually the defendant's obstinance, refusal to accept a finding that he sexually assaulted Tony. I mean, I can speculate as to why he didn't accept the second plea, but the fact is he didn't. And it wasn't because of what his attorney did. It was some factor that's unrelated to his attorney. I respectfully disagree that there was no genuine confusion about what was going on in this change of plea colloquy. I think, Judge Hamilton, you're kind of getting to a key issue in this case, which is there was no meeting of the minds, it appears, in this plea agreement itself. The defendant, it looks like, believed that he could get this enhancement based on the pattern of sexual abuse enhancement based on possession of child pornography. He couldn't. And so when he gets up there and he denies the very facts that could underlie that enhancement, the only facts that could underlie the enhancement, he's breached the agreement where he says, I'm going to recommend this guideline applies, but there are no facts that support it. Perhaps he could have stood mute, but that isn't what he did. He denied the facts. And so now when probation goes back or when Judge Moody has to consider it, they have an under oath denial by the defendant that he committed this conduct. You have to weigh it against, we would have submitted the police reports, the videotaped interviews of Tony. But the only benefit to the government in this case with this plea agreement is to keep Tony off the stand. That's why we gave him what I think is pretty accurately characterized as a sweetheart deal based on his conduct. We were trying to spare this teen or preteen, I think at that boy, the opportunity, the responsibility of taking the stand. And so when defendant gets up there and says, I did not sexually assault him, we've lost the benefit of the bargain for us in this case. And defense counsel, I think, recognized that and he appropriately dealt with it. At the very least, his performance as it relates to the plea was not so below the Sixth Amendment standard that he's entitled to this plea again. Your Honors, unless this court has any questions on the plea negotiations, I'll just turn to the actual.
If I could just ask you, Mr. Whalen, when do you think the government was bound?
Your Honor, I've taken the position in talking to our attorneys that when both parties enter into the agreement, we are bound by its terms. Now, I think there's the subsequent question of whether
let's suppose you sign a plea agreement with somebody, and in between the signatures and the change of plea hearing, new evidence comes to light that shows that convinces you that this is a really bad deal for the people. Are you prohibited by law from backing out at that point?
I think it depends on the new evidence as it relates to the crime that the defendant's going to plead to. Yeah, Your Honor, I don't think we're prohibited. Well, I think we are prohibited, frankly, from backing out. I think we've entered into an agreement, and unless there's some carve out in the agreement that lets us get out of it, it could go to denial of acceptance of responsibility or something like that. I think we are bound. Now, I think we would present, unless it's barred by the terms of the plea agreement, that evidence to the district court. And in a case like this, Your Honor's point is well taken that the district court could say, in light of this new evidence, this plea is way too lenient, and I'm refusing to let the parties into it. Because we are dismissing a count, that's a prerogative of the district court as it relates to this case. But I mean, I don't think we could come in. I think the case that we talk about in our brief is a pretty good example. If the parties say there is the defendant's entitled to the enhancement, he's entitled to reduction for acceptance of responsibility and not possessing a gun. If we then come back and introduce evidence of a gun, even if we discovered it after the fact, I do think that's problematic behavior on the behalf of the government. You know, we've entered into this agreement and we are bound by it. I am unaware of any law that says the government's bound, but the defense isn't. You know, there are some situations where the government is held.
But you would agree the defendant is free to pull out until the final question from the district judge, correct?
This was done with a magistrate. The defense was actually entitled to pull out a little bit before that. You know, they had 14 days after the magistrate accepted it to withdraw the plea for a fair, 14 days to withdraw for no reason, and then after that, a fair adjustment.
I'm talking about withdrawal for no reason. I changed my mind.
Before the district court accepts it? Yeah, I do think defense is probably entitled to pull out from that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. But I don't think it ultimately matters in this case, because I do think there was a breach as to the terms of the plea agreement. And as Chief Judge Sykes recognized, there is no prejudice. As it relates to the trial ineffectiveness, Your Honors, I'm not sure there's a whole lot to cover. This court talked about the evidence in this case being airtight and very strong in its first opinion. Nothing has changed between now and then. There was a victim who the defendant took on a road trip he had basically no connection with for 2 weeks, sexually assaulted the victim. The victim then said he had a gun, which was later confirmed by other evidence, including the fact that the defendant regularly went to the shooting range. He had child pornography on the very computer that he ultimately admitted to possessing child pornography on. And there's another victim who corroborated the fact that the defendant is engaging in sexual abuse. I think when we're talking about the Sixth Amendment analysis, you have to consider the hand the defense attorney was dealt. And this defense attorney was dealt a guilty client with extremely strong evidence against him. And in light of that, I think he performed above the Sixth Amendment standard. He tried to keep out evidence of the Florida case. The district court just, I think, correctly applied the law and let it in. He tried to distance himself from some of the arguments and say the government was, you know, trying to convict my client based on implication. I think even defense recognizes in their brief that the defendant at times, defense attorney at times, did an admirable job with what he had. Unless this court has any particular questions on any of the trial issues or the sentencing issues, I guess we would otherwise rest on our briefs.
Mr. Whalen, I was just curious. Yes. At several points in the decision on the post-conviction motion, the judge characterized this as a largely circumstantial case. I didn't see it that way. I thought there was lots of direct evidence, including from the victim. It's a direct evidence case with a great deal of circumstantial corroboration, perhaps, is a better characterization. You've done this for a long time. How would you characterize this case?
I apologize, Judge Sykes. I do believe your characterization. There was lots of direct evidence. It's not just of the assault, not just of the possession of child porn, but as it relates to the gun offenses too. I do think when Judge Moody talks about it being a circumstantial case, he was talking about the circumstances that corroborated Tony and Kyle's statements. You know, the agent did go through and they followed Mr. Resnick's transactions in his long haul truck across the country. The government was able to put on the state trooper who pulled him over in Washington. I believe that's what Judge Moody found. I'm inclined to think he probably wouldn't have given the defendant life plus 7 if he thought this was just a purely circumstantial case. Maybe I'm wrong on that fact. But I think if you look at a sentencing decision that shows the strength that he believes of the evidence of the government's evidence in this case.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. We ask that you affirm the judgment below.
All right, Mr. Edelstein.
Okay, I'll be brief, judges. First of all, this is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, which under the Massaro case does not have to be raised on direct appeal. It's not a direct claim of breach of the plea agreement. It's cognizable in a 2255 motion. As to the government stating that the benefit of the plea agreement was to keep Tony off the stand, we've shown in our reply brief it would not have had to put Tony on the stand. It could have used his interview with the police. This would not have been contested. And that Mr. Whalen referred to the case that relied upon by the government making its point, I would imagine he's talking about the Grimm case. The Grimm case also says that a defendant is not required to volunteer evidence beyond the offense of admissions beyond the offense of conviction. So I think the Grimm case proves our point. Now, in terms of the trial, there is certainly, Chief Judge Sykes pointed out, circumstantial corroboration. We've never denied that. However, the top count is based on Tony's word against Mr. Resnick's. And I would hesitate to call any count like that airtight or overwhelming. The credibility of the victim is essential. And for the counsel to, as he admitted doing, not even consult with a behavioral expert regarding whether the government's behavioral expert might be cross-examined, to not say word one, you know, ask question one in cross-examination, to not object to evidence that he knew was objectionable, including evidence of a polygraph refusal that directly implicated his right to counsel, I would submit that the totality of that, weighing the prejudice cumulatively, does have a better than negligible chance that it affected the outcome. I am out of time. Therefore, I thank the court for entertaining this argument, and I will rest on the brief.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advice.